This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, the UN sanctions North Korea, and Senator Lieberman gets an apology for an attack on his civil rights record. Joining us today from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., economist and author Julianne Malveaux, president and CEO of Last Word Productions. We've also got Walter Fields, the CEO and publisher of NorthStarNetwork.com, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education at New York University, is at member station WLIU in Southampton, New York. So welcome to you all, and let's jump right back into North Korea, which we've been following closely on our roundtable and on our show. So one of the more remarkable things about this Security Council voting unanimously for sanctions against North Korea is that the Security Council includes China, which has been a strong ally of North Korea. And the sanctions include blocking the sale of weapons-related materials, allowing other nations, including China, to inspect incoming cargo. And perhaps a bit oddly, they also ban the sale of luxury goods to the nation. And Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is headed to South Korea this week. I just have to start with the luxury goods. Julianne, what's that all about?
It really does speak to, I think, implicitly some of the ways of hitting those in power, because obviously this is not a nation that's a wealthy nation, but those in power will directly be affected by the luxury goods. You know that in the developing world, there have been all kinds of questions raised about where foreign aid goes and who gets it and who's corrupt. And so, I mean, it's an implicit kind of slap on the wrist, but you're right, Farai. It's a discordant note in this entire debacle. Over, you know, who has nuclear weapons, who has a right to have nuclear weapons, and frankly, whether or not sanctions work. I mean, the other sanctions, the other economic sanctions are likely to be far more powerful. So this just seems to be sort of like an underpinning, if you will.
Let me follow up with you before I get to everyone else. Some people have challenged how effective sanctions were in Iraq before the war, the U.S. war, saying that the people who bore the brunt of the sanctions were children and poor people and so on. How do you look at sanctions in terms of their effectiveness at reaching the leaders of the nations as opposed to the people in the nations?
Well, we have lots of examples of sanctions really not working, and then we have a few examples of sanctions working. I think that sanctions worked, for example, Farai, in South Africa, when people attempted to make the country ungovernable by dropping investment. But I think that if we look at Cuba, for example, the poor people, the people who need medication are the people who are hurt. If we look at Iran and India and Pakistan, we have not seen effective sanctions. The leaders are free to ignore the sanctions, and poor people are the ones who suffer. We have to develop better responses to display world displeasure. And I'm not sure that sanctions are always the best way. We like them. We use them. They make a strong point. But if they don't work, what difference do they make?
Marcelo, what about that, sanctions?
Not a precise science or an art, for that matter. What we really need is a combination of carrots and sticks. It's very, very clear that sanctions, unilateral sanctions, or even multilateral sanctions by themselves, some exceptions, as we've just heard, don't typically tend to work. There is a kind of a comical relief here, no Gucci bags for the North Korean leadership. It's not at all clear how that really plays into our geopolitical interest in this case. Clearly, this signifies the end of kind of the unilateralism that has characterized the Bush administration up to this point. We really need to get the Chinese and the Russians on board on this. This is really the resuscitation of a major UN push to multilaterally come to terms with an immensely complex, difficult, and really dangerous situation.
Walter, one of our contributors, Mario Armstrong, just came back from South Korea, which is, you know, a mirror opposite of North Korea. It's a prosperous country, very high tech. There's broadband access or wireless access almost everywhere in the country. And Condoleezza Rice is headed to South Korea, which is, you know, much more a part of the world community. Will that just antagonize the North Koreans more. I mean, she's going there to meet also with the foreign minister of Japan. Or it seems like a very difficult tightrope to walk.
Well, I don't know if this one trip is going to antagonize the relationship anymore. I mean, clearly there's an issue here that's long simmering, that there's been little diplomacy in regards to the United States and North Korea. So issues of even thinking about the possibilities of unification of both ends of Korea have been almost impossible to even think about. I think one of the challenges here is that the UN now is going to be headed by a South Korean as a new Secretary General, and I think that's going to also raise some tensions. But the real outlier here is China. And even though it was a unanimous vote in the Security Council to impose sanctions, if China does not fully participate in that process, then these sanctions are hollow. I think you're absolutely right. There's got to be carrots and sticks. And apparently right now the only thing that people are looking at is the stick. And I don't believe the North Korean government is necessarily going to budge because, you know, the UN Security Council has issued sanctions. I think we've got to go back to the process by which we begin to try to talk through some of these very difficult global challenges, like how do you make sure that that region of the world is safe, and how do you limit opportunities for every country, including the United States, to use a nuclear arsenal to pose as a threat to other neighboring nations.
I'm sure there's going to be a lot more news about this week as the Secretary of State goes to South Korea. But I want to move on to something a little closer to home. The Connecticut campaign race to the Senate exploded last week after Ned Lamont, who is the official Democratic candidate, received an endorsement from the state's Federation of Black Democratic Clubs. Now, that federation questioned Senator Joe Lieberman's support for civil rights in the 1960s. The senator's camp was outraged. You know, he's now running as an independent, Senator Lieberman. And even Lamont's people thought it was a low blow. On WNPR radio station, Lamont was confronted by one of his own campaign supporters.
Frankly, I was taken by surprise. I should have stood up and said at the time that that's unsubstantiated. It's not part of what I believe.
Your campaign has got to come forward with more than just a press release. You know, you've got to hammer that home that you disassociate yourself with that.
Well, look, I take Joe Lieberman at his word regarding his service back in the 1960s. I disassociate myself from any other comments made, at that press conference.
And in addition, of course, Lieberman has been sparring with the Reverend Al Sharpton. You know, can't we all just get along, Julianne?
Not at all. Not in this one. The fact is that Henry Parker is a respected civil rights leader who's a former state treasurer of Connecticut. While I don't think that you can assail Joe Lieberman for his commitment in the 1960s, I certainly think that he can be assailed for his commitment thereafter. Maxine Waters went up to Connecticut to support Lamont. Others, Al Sharpton and others have, because quite frankly, remember, let's not forget 2000. Let's not forget that Joe Lieberman was the tepid choice of African-American Democrats for vice president, that indeed he had been shaky on affirmative action and other issues. He wants to take the moral high ground now, but let's really take a close look at his record. Yes, he marched with Dr. King. I'm going to give him props for that. Yes, he went to Mississippi, and he deserves props for that. But what has he done after that? And I think that it's legitimate to raise questions about that.
Marcello, we have a situation now where it looks like Lamont is running slightly behind Lieberman, although the polls change day to day. How damaging is it to someone who was kind of a, you know, unusual candidate, Ned Lamont, you know, challenging this very established senator, to now get into a rift over Lieberman's history?
Well, it's not going to be easy. He has a difficult battle ahead, and In many ways, it's too early to tell, but Lieberman is coming back. He's leading in the polls, and we still have an eternity from now until Election Day. But my sense is that this will not help the Lamont candidacy.
More sex scandals, more political scandals. I guess anything could happen. But before we find out about any of that, Walter, you know, there was some discussion, not just in the black community, of whether America was ready for a Jewish vice president, the same way when Geraldine Ferraro was running, is America ready for a female vice president? Do you think that those questions of, you know, sort of ethnic unease, get mixed up with the question of what actually is Senator Lieberman's record, because he wasn't always in support of affirmative action, and he made that clear.
Well, not necessarily. I think the problem here is that, you know, many of our elected officials' commitment to civil rights is steeped in nostalgia. And I think we have to have had so many politicians who go back to the tried and true, you know, I marched with Dr. King. And I always said if everyone who says they marched with Dr. King had actually marched with Dr. King, there wouldn't have been any room on the streets. I think we have to really kind of look at the reality here. There were a lot of people who were, quote-unquote, supportive of the civil rights movement. But that shouldn't necessarily be a blanket issue of support in today's environment. I think you have to look at what people are doing today and whether or not they are currently engaged in a campaign for equity in the United States. And I think you can challenge Joe Lieberman on that point. So while, you know, I think there is some controversy over whether or not the statement is true from a historical perspective, someone needs to be raising the issue of where do you stand today, mm-hmm. and not allow people to fall back into this comfortable zone of saying, I marched with, or, you know, I supported back in 1960, which is now 40 years ago. So I think, you know, there's still a lot of room there in terms of critique Joe Lieberman's record on this issue.
Well, Julianne, Connecticut is by no means an all-white state, but it's not a state like California or New York with the hugest preponderance of voters of color. Why has this issue really become foregrounded?
I think that Joe Lieberman is looking for a fight. You're right. I mean, Connecticut has, I think the black population there is well under 10%. It's probably about 7. Henry Parker, as I say, is someone who has been very respected. He's one of the few African Americans who's been elected to statewide office there. This is really the Connecticut Federation of Black Democratic Club's endorsement of Lamont is really a blow to Lieberman, and I think he's prepared to fight it out. And I think, as Marcello says, when he chooses to fight it out, it tarnishes Lamont. It really doesn't, the funk doesn't fall back on the African-American Democrats. It really does fall back on Lamont. So Lamont really needs to galvanize those African-Americans who've been supporting him. He needs to bring people like Maxine back to make it clear that there were reasons why this statement was made. It's totally incorrect, again, to say he didn't march in 1960. I don't know. I wasn't there. But, you know, whatever. It's that. But that's not the point, as Walter makes. The real point is, where do you stand for civil rights now? And quite frankly, Lieberman's stand has been a weak one.
All right, let's move on to one last topic. The Sentencing Project released a new report revealing a growing interest in reforms of state felony voting laws and restoration of voting rights. Now, this is really a state-by-state issue. Some states allow felons to vote from inside the prison walls, and other states disenfranchise you forever. And so, basically, 16 states since 1997 have implemented reforms that have reduced the restrictiveness of these laws, and more than 600,000 people have regained their voting rights. Now, is this a sign that these laws, which came to birth during, you know, the post-Reconstruction era mainly, are getting rolled back? I guess, Marcello, do you see this as something that is a national wave, and if so, is it progress?
Well, the numbers are so huge and how they disproportionately affect the African-American, the Latino voting population is such that we really need to think about what it means for a democracy when hundreds of thousands of people who did their time, paid their dues to society, are permanently disenfranchised from the political process, the process that is at the very, very heart of the democratic promise. We really, as we have the highest incarceration rate of any advanced post-industrial democracy in the world, we really need to look at this very, very seriously.
Yes, Julianne?
I agree with Marcello. I think that clearly re-enfranchising felons is important. People have paid their debt to society. They should not be permanently disenfranchised. And we've seen the distortions, certainly in the 2000 election, the 2004 election, in the ways that these lists have been used for scurrilous purposes. So once people have done the time, paid society, they should be fully participating citizens. It develops a level of alienation in addition to everything else. I applaud these changes, but I think they clearly don't go far enough. And obviously we have the states' rights thing, which means that various states have the choice to make. I think in states where you have heavy African-American populations and heavy levels of African-American incarceration, we have to look very carefully at the motives of those who refuse to basically re-enfranchise people.
And Walter, some of the, you know, the background on this is that these laws often came to birth during the period when African Americans were first allowed to vote. Now, even yet today, an estimated 1 in 12 African Americans is disenfranchised, and that's five times the rate of non-African Americans. It's very difficult sometimes to get traction with issues of crime in public discourse because it's kind of one of those third rail issues that politicians don't like to address. Should there be a national movement in Congress to really stop making this a state-by-state issue and create a federal policy?
Well, it's going to be difficult to make this a federal policy when voting is a state matter. But there are some real implications in terms of political power. In New York State, for example, control of the state Senate is really contingent upon a couple of senatorial districts in which felons, incarcerated individuals, make up a sizable plurality of the district. And if they were allowed to vote in their home districts, it would shift political power, and you'd see a change in partisan control of the state Senate. So there is a real underlying, bottom-line issue here in terms of votes not being counted where they should be counted and communities not getting the benefit of those votes because those votes are locked away. So I think we have to really approach it as a state-level matter because election law is a state function. And I think in certain states it's obvious in terms of the disfranchisement that has occurred, places such as New York. Other places it's not as obvious because you have different statutes regarding the issue of felons voting. But I think there are some real political implications here that we better take a look at because it's our community that is harmed by this issue.
We've been talking with Walter Field, CEO and publisher of NorthStarNetwork.com. In NPR headquarters, Julianne Malveaux, president and CEO of Last Word Productions. And from WLIU in Southampton, New York, Marcelo Suarez Orozco of New York University. Thank you all.
Thank you, Farai.
Thank you.